It's Wednesday, November 16th, and Donald Trump is running for president again. We start here. In a defiant speech, the former president who shattered Democratic norms says he wants to return to the White House.
In order to make America great and glorious again, I am tonight announcing my candidacy for president of the United States.
Don't skip ahead to a Biden rematch. This immediately sets up a war in the Republican Party. Meanwhile, the GOP looks certain to control the House.
The era of one-party Democrat rule in Washington is over.
But can the folks who were just elected decide who's going to lead them? And Russia's been bombing Ukraine for months, but if they bomb a NATO country, everything changes.
This is all now about de-escalation.
Now, Western leaders are hoping they're not being dragged into a war. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. A few weeks ago, former President Donald Trump was making it clear he is planning on running for the White House again. It was just a question of when.
I will very, very, very probably do it again, okay? Very, very, very probably.
After all, he had spent months stumping for his favorite candidates in the midterm elections. Some journalists were hearing he wanted to announce before Election Day to excite voters and to soak up the credit when those candidates won.
Carrie Lake, your next governor. She's an incredible woman.
I want to have the focus tonight be on Dr. Oz and on Doug Mastriano.
He was reportedly convinced to hold off his announcement until after Election Night, but Election Night didn't go as planned.
If Dr. Oz doesn't pull this off, they're going to be questioning whether or not having former President Trump there in the final day or two was the right call.
Republicans won races, but not as many as they were expecting.
You have a lot of Trump allies that are being defeated.
I think general election voters are sending my party a really big message.
They didn't just fail to pick up Senate seats, they lost a Senate seat. And the most concerning part of all this was which candidates were underperforming.
Already Carrie Lake is making very loud complaints about the way the election is run.
The fake media back there tried to tell us we were wrong for asking questions about our elections.
The candidates falling flattest with voters were the ones who had explicitly shaped themselves in Donald Trump's image. The most MAGA Republicans were becoming the most rejected Republicans.
Katie Hobbs narrowly defeating Carrie Lake.
Dr. Oz called to concede the race.
Josh Shapiro will be our next governor.
Which might be why, over the last several days, we've seen Republicans distancing themselves more than ever from the former president.
Do you believe that Donald Trump should ever be president again?
In an exclusive sit-down interview with ABC's David Muir, former Vice President Mike Pence gave his strongest rebuke yet of former President Trump.
David, I think that's up to the American people. But I think we'll have better choices in the future.
Like, if the criticism had been that some Republicans are too scared to go after Trump, they don't seem as scared right now.
I would just tell people to go check out the scoreboard from last Tuesday night. The fact of the matter is...
But as the calls to delay grew even louder, none of that stopped Donald Trump last night, a former president who upended Democratic norms and defended a revolt at the Capitol, from coming out at Mar-a-Lago and officially beginning his bid to get back into the White House.
In order to make America great and glorious again, I am tonight announcing my candidacy for president of the United States.
ABC's Jonathan Carl is at Mar-a-Lago right now. In fact, he's outside of the room where he was watching this play out. John, this seemed rather different from the Golden Escalator speech. Can you just describe this announcement?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, it was a much more disciplined Donald Trump. He basically stuck to the script. He gave a speech that Republicans, the kind of speech that they want him to give, which is contrasting what they see as the successes of the Donald Trump administration with the problems facing America now under Joe Biden.
We are a failing nation. For millions of Americans, the past 2 years under Joe Biden have been a time of pain, hardship, anxiety, and despair. As we speak, inflation is the highest in over 50 years.
When Trump was president, we had low inflation, the border was secure, America had good relations with China and North Korea and Iran and Russia were in check, and now the whole world's falling apart. I mean, that's not really the portrait of reality, but it's the kind of contrast that Republicans would like him to focus on rather than talking endlessly about how the 2020 election, you know, was stolen and all that kind of stuff. He didn't mention that stuff at all. I mean, none of those false allegations about voter fraud and a stolen election, that was not this speech.
The raid of Mar-a-Lago, think of it. And I say, why didn't you raid Bush's place? Why didn't you raid Clinton? 32,000 emails. Why didn't you raid Clinton's place? Why didn't you do Obama, who took a lot of things with him? We will dismantle the deep state and restore government by the people.
I mean, there wasn't much of a presence of party leadership at all in that room. I mean, it didn't look like a former president launching a campaign. I only saw one member of Congress in the crowd, and it was Madison Cawthorn, who's only going to be a member of Congress until this session of Congress is over, because he lost his reelection bid. And as for low energy...
Yeah, please sit down. I feel so guilty having you stand.
This was certainly not a big rally speech. At one point, Donald Trump asked people to sit down. You go ahead and sit down, and people sat down. And I did notice people leaving early, and enough people were leaving early that they ended up stopping people and said you couldn't leave until it was over, citing security. I don't know what the security would be that would make people need to stay, but they literally stopped people from leaving.
Yeah, and why last night then, John? Like, if there weren't members of Congress who wanted to be there, if there were people who were trying to, like, make their way out casually, like, why was this the moment for him?
Great question. None of his advisors wanted him to go forward with this last night. They wanted him to wait. They thought the timing was terrible because, you know, so close to the midterm losses. And because there's a Georgia runoff next month and they didn't want to get in the middle of that. So his advisors and a lot of his supporters were telling him and urging him to delay. This happened last night for one reason and one reason only. It's because Donald Trump wanted to get it going.
He was an incredible athlete. He'll be an even better senator. Get out and vote for Herschel Walker. We elected a group of incredibly talented America First leaders who will be stars of our party for many years to come.
Why? I mean, we can speculate as to why, but it's unclear given that his, you know, his political advisors didn't think it was politically advantageous to do so.
Going forward, John, like, what, we're in a campaign now. Like, he's filed the paperwork even. What is this campaign about to look like? Because, like, I get that there are no members of Congress there because they're all just trying to, like, stay out of this. But Donald Trump doesn't let you do that, right? He doesn't let you not pick sides. You've got other Republicans who are clearly planning to mount runs of their own. What's going to happen between all of them?
I mean, he is going to certainly demand loyalty. And, you know, this was one other notable thing about this speech is he didn't attack any fellow Republicans. He didn't go after Ron DeSantis. He didn't go after his own former vice president, who's been quite critical of him over the last few days. He didn't do any of that. But this is going to be a hard hitting campaign because Donald Trump they're not going to step out of the way. I mean, Donald Trump's going to have to fight to get this nomination. Also, by the way, it's a pretty scaled down campaign. I mean, this looks a lot more like what it looked like in 2015 when he first launched his campaign, and there were a handful of advisors who went around with him everywhere. There's no big campaign apparatus, at least not yet.
It's confusing to me, though, John, because, like, I remember a time lots of Republicans were saying Donald Trump shouldn't run. It was a month before the general election in 2016, and the Access Hollywood tape had just come out. People were literally saying, like, he should drop out. Mike Pence should take his place. Well, guess what? Voters had a different idea. I guess I'm wondering what, in Republicans' minds right now, in 2022, what makes Donald Trump untouchable for them that might not have applied then? Is something different?
I think that it's the sense that he is a loser. I think that Republicans believe that they would have won those two Senate seats in Georgia last year, in, you know, 2021. And I believe that they, you know, and Republicans certainly believe they would have had a much better midterms and they would have won back the Senate this time if it weren't for Donald Trump.
Much criticism is being placed on the fact that the Republican Party should have done better. And frankly, much of this blame is correct. But the citizens of our country have not yet realized the full extent and gravity of the pain our nation is going through. And the total effect of the suffering is just starting to take hold.
Donald Trump can be a force in a Republican Party, a decisive force in a Republican primary, but he is a general election loser. And that's why they want to move beyond him. But, you know, they also fear that if Donald Trump gets upset and leaves the Republican Party and runs as an independent, then there's no way they can win under that circumstance either. So they're playing a delicate dance with Donald Trump. They want him to move on, but they fear how he will move on.
Right, right. And we've also, of course, now seen what happens when Donald Trump becomes President Trump. Perhaps that weighing as well on the minds of these lawmakers who have now been through several cycles of this. All right, John Carl at Mar-a-Lago, thanks so much.
Thank you, Brad.
Now, if there's a struggle over who should lead the Republican Party this morning, the presidential campaign is not the most pressing issue. That's 2 years away, people. As I say this, Republicans are on the brink of winning the 218th seat that would give them control of the House. There's almost no scenario at this point where Democrats hold on to it. So yesterday, Republicans gathered on Capitol Hill to decide who will become Speaker of the House, second in line to the presidency after the VP. Let's go to ABC's congressional correspondent Rachel Scott, who's at the Capitol right now. Rachel, who do they settle on? Who's going to be Speaker?
Well, listen, Brad, I think if you talk to most Republicans up here on Capitol Hill, they say that Kevin McCarthy is the obvious choice, right? It's a no-brainer.
I'm 100% behind Kevin, always have been since day one, and I think he's definitely done the work necessary to get us into this majority and will help us to deliver on our priorities.
He is the coach that led them to the Super Bowl. They're on the brink of winning majority in the House. Many believe that he should be the Speaker of the House.
I'm proud to announce the era of one-party Democrat rule in Washington is over.
We'll then enter some of the most conservative members, a part of the Republican conference, something that's called the House Freedom Caucus.
You know, we have a new paradigm here, and I think the country wants a different direction from the House of Representatives.
They mounted a challenge to Republican leader Kevin McCarthy behind closed doors. The way that this all ended up shaking out is Kevin McCarthy did win the nomination to serve as Speaker of the House. But Brad, this was just the first step, and he didn't win every single vote. You actually had 31 Republicans that voted against him.
And so what does that mean? Like, does that mean then if you win the nomination and Republicans will control the House, we think, does that mean he'll definitely be Speaker, or what happens next?
No, not exactly, right? So this is really just the first step. This is really the first test. He needs 218 votes to be elected Speaker of the House. That vote's going to happen in January. And yesterday, he only had 188 that supported him. So this is not a given by any measure.
We want new leadership. We want fresh faces and new ideas.
You have people like Republican Matt Gaetz, who is not supporting McCarthy. He says that McCarthy couldn't get 218 votes. He couldn't get 200 votes. He couldn't even get 190 votes. So to believe that Kevin McCarthy is going to be the next speaker, you have to believe that he's going to get votes in 6 weeks that he couldn't get in the last 6 years. And you know it's a problem for Republicans when they're reaching out to Democrats. I learned from several sources that his allies are trying to persuade at least one moderate member of the Democratic Party to actually switch parties. And this is Democratic Representative Henry Cuellar. He told me that he has received multiple calls from people close to McCarthy, including one current Republican member. And they basically asked him, name your price. Tell us what you want. He declined those. He said, no, thank you. But it's just a sign of just how desperate Republicans are to get McCarthy to be the next speaker.
Yeah. And the speakership is clearly the most important job. But like, there are all the leadership slots kind of up for votes here, right? Like, what are there other ones we should be keeping an eye on?
Yeah, Brad, I got to tell you, the Republican infighting, it is really going on in both chambers. So we've been running from the House over to the Senate. During this closed-door luncheon with Senate Republicans, you had this unexpected announcement from Senator Rick Scott, who announced a bid to challenge leader Mitch McConnell during this GOP lunch. And he put out this letter to his Republican colleagues in which he says that he's deeply disappointed by the results of the current election. And he also believes that voters want a plan. He says that, unfortunately, we have continued to elect leadership who refuses to do that and elicits attacks on anyone that does.
I'll be nominating Rick Scott. I think we need a different governing model for our conference. I think we need a far more collaborative one.
He's talking specifically about leader Mitch McConnell. And so the big question is does Senator Rick Scott stand a chance? Likely not.
I have the votes. I will be elected. The only issue is whether we do it sooner or later.
McConnell says himself that he has the votes, that he will be the minority leader. But this is significant because we believe that this is the first challenger McConnell has faced in 15 years. Not to mention here, there's a lot of irony going on because here you have Rick Scott calling out McConnell in this very tense meeting over not having a plan. Well, Rick Scott was leading up the GOP campaign effort this midterm election, and you had Republicans that came up very short in the Senate.
Like, he was the guy in charge of being like, we're going to send money to this candidate because we think they had the best shot to win. And then a bunch of those candidates just got demolished.
And now he's saying, elect me. I want to lead the party.
Fascinating. Yeah, you texted me yesterday and said, wow, Republican Senate right now is kind of spicy. All right, Rachel Scott, we'll let you go cool off. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, no one wants a war between Russia and NATO, so why did two missiles just land in Poland? We're back in a bit.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
Married moms in the suburbs. They've been called soccer moms. They've been called security moms.
Pamela Wilk is a so-called soccer mom.
Those so-called Walmart moms.
She calls herself a hockey mom.
I love those hockey moms.
The hockey mom trying to connect with the soccer moms.
In the 1990s, the idea of soccer moms as the quintessential swing voter took hold. Elections could be won or lost based on a candidate's ability to appeal to them. But were quote-unquote soccer moms actually the deciding factor? In a new series on the 538 Politics podcast, we take a look back at conventional wisdom from past elections with a critical lens. Where did that wisdom come from, and does it hold up today? Find the Campaign Throwback series in the 538 Politics feed wherever you get your podcasts.
The Ukrainians' recapture of the city of Kherson has been called one of the biggest moments of this war, not just for people from that city, but for the entire region. After all, people started wondering, if Russian troops are on the run, could Ukraine keep marching up behind them? Could they advance further? Could territories like Crimea suddenly be back in play? Well, yesterday, in what appeared to be a response to its latest humiliation, Russia began launching missiles at cities across Ukraine. But perhaps the missiles that could prove most consequential here are the two that might have fallen outside of Ukraine's borders. ABC's foreign correspondent James Longman is in that newly reclaimed city of Kherson right now. I mean, James, before we talk about what's happening in Kherson, can you just walk me through what happened yesterday with this sort of missile assault?
Yeah, Russia sent its largest ever barrage of missiles over into Ukraine. 100, we're told.
Of course, we don't have the technical ability to knock down 100% of Russian missiles and strike drones, he said, but added he is sure that Ukraine would gradually achieve that with help from their partners.
They hit pretty much every single major town and city in this country, hitting major infrastructure targets. It's plunged much of the country into darkness, 50% of Kyiv, 80% of Lviv. And so that has been the aim. The last few weeks and months, we've seen that as a tactic of Russia to try to demoralize the Ukrainian people by taking away their power and their energy. Just as we're about to hit some of the coldest weather, it's no accident that this is literally days ahead of when the first snow is forecast for Ukraine, some of the most bitter temperatures. And so this massive barrage hits Ukraine, and lo and behold, we hear news that something has hit Poland.
We are following those unconfirmed reports that two Russian rockets have landed within Poland, killing two people.
It has been unclear as to who exactly is responsible for this. Russia has been accused by both Ukraine and Poland.
We are aware of the press reports alleging that two Russian missiles have struck a location inside Poland near the Ukraine border.
It's killed two people. Apparently, grain silos have been hit. Obviously, this has got the entire world very, very concerned. Poland is a NATO country. And so a huge amount of speculation about what this could mean. There's that Article 5. Everyone talks about it. An attack on one is an attack on all.
Yeah, that's the thing, because we still don't necessarily know this was even from Russia. They denied it. You can imagine a scenario where this could have been a Ukrainian defense missile, or Ukraine hit a Russian missile on its way down, and then that went into Poland. But if it is a Russian missile fired into like a NATO country, James, what is that? Does that mean that everyone from NATO, the US, the UK, everyone has to get involved?
Well, that is exactly what everybody has feared. And it has been, if you think about it, you know, the very heart of this war has been all about how close Ukraine has got to NATO and whether or not an attack on Ukraine could then prompt the whole of NATO to get involved in a war with Russia. From Moscow to DC, no one wants World War III.
We're not going to get ahead of ourselves here. We're going to get the facts. And when we have more to provide, we will.
It's very likely that this was a mistake. Russia will never admit to a mistake, if indeed it was Russia. Yes, we know about Article 5, which is an attack on one, an attack on all. But there's also Article 4, which is all about consultation. And you can bet that the United States, as the senior partner here, will be consulting very hard with Poland to make sure that this does not escalate, even though there has been quite a lot of rhetoric, not just from Poland, but from Baltic states, who are all very concerned. All the countries that border Ukraine and Russia are terrified, have been over the last 9 months, and it's made them even more worried. But this is all now about de-escalation.
It's unlikely in the minds of the trajectory that it was fired from Russia, but we'll see.
Ukraine has laid the blame very squarely at Moscow's feet and said this is Russia actively targeting a NATO state. Ukrainians have been saying from the very beginning that this is what Russia will do. So it plays into Zelensky's narrative, which is that this war is much bigger than just Ukraine. And certainly he wants more help going into winter because there's been a lot more pressure on him now to enter negotiations with Russia.
And so huge moment there along the Ukraine-Polish border. Can we talk about where you are, James? Because you're kind of our first eyes and ears inside Kherson since this liberation, I guess, from the Ukrainian military. What are you hearing? What's it like there?
It's been incredibly moving. There haven't been many moments in this war that have been uplifting personally to cover, but this has been very much one of them. Everybody who you meet is just overcome with joy. The overwhelming sense when the Russians were here was powerlessness.
It's James.
Lisa.
Do you speak any English? No, that's fine. Should we go inside?
I spoke to a young woman who worked as a waitress in a bar here in a restaurant, and she had to serve Russian soldiers. And she painted a picture which was frankly terrifying for a young girl in her early 20s.
They would come here very open to drink and eat, and they would bring some girls with them, and they would try to flirt with me, just like...
Large groups of violent, drunk, unruly individuals who are armed, who played games with them every day, whether they would live or die, frequently kind of threatened her with sexual violence.
Once there was a situation when one drunk guy loaded his gun and he pushed it against my stomach and he was saying, like, you come with me, where do you live? I want to go with you to the place where you live. And the only thought I would have by the end of each day is, thank God that I'm alone. So it was like a constant fear on a daily basis.
That is just one example, but this was life under Russian occupation. And so I think the picture I get is one of tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people living cowed, eyes to the ground, whenever they were outside, making sure they didn't come into eye contact with their Russian occupiers, terrified.
Don't draw attention to yourself at all.
Exactly. Terrified of what could happen to them, hoping and praying for the Ukrainian military to come and get them. And in the end, of course, they did. And it was extraordinary to be stood on that central square as you saw sort of singing and dancing children. But again, the sound of the bombs in the distance, mine clearance, yes, but also this constant outgoing and incoming of artillery fire, and not a single person flinches when that happens. Children as young as 4 or 5 dancing and singing who can hear the bombs and do not move when they hear them. It became a part of their lives. Now, of course, they've been liberated, but as we've seen with this huge volley of missile attacks across the country, nowhere in Ukraine is completely safe from Russia.
And like so much of the country, I know that you're in sort of darkness as well, as so much power has been knocked out. James Longman in Kherson, stay safe and thank you.
Thanks a lot, Brad.
Okay, one more quick break. When we come back, if you're looking for strange artistic choices, don't ever sleep on the French. Un Last Thing is next.
People who disappear without a trace.
Where is she?
The most notorious murder cases in New York.
Pure evil.
And the most devious killers.
There's a Hannibal Lecter feel to him.
For chilling true crime stories, follow the True Crime NYC podcast wherever you listen.
And one last thing. For the last 50 years, Olympic Games have had mascots.
My personal favorite? Bing Dwin Dwin, the Olympic mascot that, let me just tell you, everyone here on the ground is obsessed with.
You might remember Bing Dwin Dwin, the panda from Beijing this past winter, or Sam the Eagle from the 84 Summer Games. Well, yesterday, the city of Paris revealed its mascots for 2024, the figures that will tell the world what these games are all about. And the 2024 mascots are hats. Yes, the mascots that will be prancing around Paris are huge, walking, red hats called frieze. A frieze looks like a little red beanie, I guess, like with some ear flaps. It was worn by Marianne, the fictional woman who was basically the mascot of the French Revolution. And this hat appears on the flags of several Latin American countries. It's rarely depicted, though, with eyes and legs sticking out of it.
What this will say is if someone from the French Revolution could come back and look at this, would they like it? With those little googly eyes, those friendly eyes.
Plot twist.
The truth is, this is not the first weird Olympics mascot. The very first one was basically a stick figure on skis. We've seen snowmen, a walking star, these kind of blobs from Athens. Like, at this point, it's shocking if you're something people do recognize. The most notable thing is not that these mascots are hats, is that they're both hats. In recent years, there have been mascots for both the Olympics and the Paralympics. In Rio, the Olympics had this cool cat-like creature. The Paralympics had a tree. In Torino, they look similar but wore different colors. In France, the only difference between one frieze and another will be that one has a prosthetic leg and the other doesn't. And that equality, designers say, is revolutionary. You will be shocked to know I did not take French at any point in my schooling. Like, this is the best pronunciation you're going to get from me, you guys. That reminds me, you can always listen to Start Here on your smart speaker. As long as you can pronounce the name of the show, you can listen to it while you start your day. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.
Married moms in the suburbs. They've been called soccer moms. They've been called security moms.
Pamela Wilk is a so-called soccer mom.
Those so-called Walmart moms.
She calls herself a hockey mom.
I love those hockey moms.
The hockey mom trying to connect with the soccer moms.
In the 1990s, the idea of soccer moms as the quintessential swing voter took hold. Elections could be won or lost based on a candidate's ability to appeal to them. But were quote-unquote soccer moms actually the deciding factor? In a new series on the 538 Politics podcast, we take a look back at conventional wisdom from past elections with a critical lens. Where did that wisdom come from, and does it hold up today? Find the Campaign Throwback series in the 538 Politics feed wherever you get your podcasts.